Elder Nolan D. Archibald is chairman of the board and president and chief executive officer of the Black & Decker Corporation. Elder Archibald joined Black & Decker a long time ago. He's been serving as president and chief operating officer in September of 1985 and then was appointed president and CEO in March of 1986. And so he's served as CEO since then. He has received many awards in his lifetime, been recognized in many different ways. In business, he's often been cited in national publications as one of the top managers in the country. He serves on the board of directors at Lockheed Martin, the Huntsman Corporation, and Brunswick Corporation, and is a member of the President's Leadership Council at BYU. He also has received a number of awards for his athletic ability, although I note that this occurred some time ago. He was an All-American basketball player and led Dixie State College to the National Junior College Finals. And when he played there, he graduated from Weber State, where he was Scholar Athlete of the Year, was an Academic All-American, and he earned a master's degree in business from the Harvard Business School. I think you'll hear a little bit more about his experiences in athletics today. Elder Archibald is married to the former Margaret Hafen. They're the parents of seven sons and one daughter. He's served as bishop twice, as president of the Washington, D.C. stake, and he's currently serving as a member of the 70. He's called as an Area 70 at April Conference in 2007. We're grateful to have him here. Look forward to hearing from him.
Thank you, President Clark. It's a great pleasure to be here with you. I have thoroughly enjoyed the time that I have been here today and had an opportunity to interact with the students and faculty, and I have been so impressed with everyone I have met and what I have seen today, and you truly are part of a great university here, and it is my pleasure to be here with you. You know, we live in a day of emails, and emails can be dangerous. Let me tell you about one. A couple from Minneapolis decided to go to Florida for a long weekend to thaw out during one particularly icy winter. They planned to stay at the same hotel where they had spent their honeymoon 20 years before. Because both had jobs, they found it difficult to coordinate their travel schedules. So it was decided that the husband would fly to Florida on a Thursday and his wife would follow him the next day. Upon arriving as planned, the husband checked into the hotel. In his room, there was a computer, so he decided to send his wife an email back to Minneapolis. However, he accidentally left out one letter in her address and sent the email without realizing his error. In Houston, a widow had just returned from her husband's funeral. The dearly departed was a minister who had been called home to glory following a heart attack. The widow checked her email, expecting messages from friends and relatives. Upon reading the first message, she fainted. The widow's son rushed into the room, found the mother on the floor, and saw the computer screen, which read, "To my loving wife, subject, I've arrived." You're probably surprised to hear from me. They have computers here now. And you're allowed to send emails back to your loved ones. I've just arrived and checked in. I see that everything has been prepared for your arrival tomorrow. Looking forward to seeing you then. Hope your journey was as uneventful as mine was. P.S. Sure is hot down here. Be careful. As I mentioned, I am so pleased to be with you today. I appreciate Dean Broadhead's and President Clark's invitation to participate in your business summit today. I have known President Clark for many, many years when he was Dean of the Harvard Business School. I served on his board of advisors at Harvard, and he now serves on my board as a director of Black & Decker Corporation. President Clark is a gifted academic and business leader, as well as a dedicated member of the church, and you are so fortunate to have someone as with his caliber and spirituality as your president. This afternoon, I thought I would start by telling you a little bit about my background, how my career has evolved, and then tell you how we turned Black & Decker around and what we're doing today to compete in a global dynamic marketplace. I came from modest circumstances. My mother and father worked for Ogden City Schools. My father worked in maintenance as a plumber, an electrician. My mother was a cook. Neither graduated from high school. Their parents were farmers in Clarkston, Utah. However, my parents taught me that I could become and do anything that I wanted in this world if I got a good education and I was willing to work hard enough to achieve my goals. As I look back on my life, there were two experiences I had as a young man that had a profound effect on my life. These two experiences have significantly affected the way that I have set and achieved goals throughout my life. After I returned from my mission, I set two goals I wanted to achieve. Somewhere along the way, I had decided I wanted a career in business, and I felt like an MBA was essential, so I set as one of my goals to get a master's degree in business administration. I also wanted to play college basketball, so I set another goal to play basketball at a Division I school. Now, both of those goals would seem to be quite achievable for someone who had been a good student in high school and who had also been an outstanding high school basketball player. I was neither. I graduated from high school with barely a 2-point grade point average, and I saw more than my share of C's and D's in high school. And I must confess, as a result, I was really frightened to go to college because of fear of failure. My second goal of playing basketball at a Division I school was even more improbable because I didn't even make my high school basketball team. According to the NCAA, there are 154,000 high school seniors who play basketball in the United States. Less than 1% play Division I college basketball, and that's 1% that played in high school, and I was cut 3 years in a row from my high school team. Since I didn't play basketball in college, I thought I had better start at a junior college. I had just returned from my mission, completely out of shape, having been inactive physically for 2 years. I remember the long 3-mile runs and weightlifting program that I put myself through in order to get into as good a physical shape as those I was competing against. There were several trying out for the team that were, one was a high school All-American, and there were several All-State players. I remember coming to practice alone, an hour early every day, just to work on the fundamentals that I had missed in high school. Somehow I made all the cuts and ended up starting on the Dixie College basketball team. I was fortunate enough to play on a team that had several talented players, and Dixie College won the regional finals and represented the West at the National Junior College Finals in Hutchinson, Kansas. We didn't win the national championship, but the national exposure resulted in me receiving over 100 scholarship offers from major universities all over the country, including Utah State, Utah, BYU, and Arizona. I chose Weber State in my hometown of Ogden, Utah. I'm often asked why I chose Weber State over other more prestigious universities. One, there was a little-known coach there at the time, Dick Motta, who went on to be one of the most successful coaches in the NBA. He had a significant influence in attracting me. And some have suggested it might have been a way for me to get back at my high school basketball coach. I like to think I'm a bigger person than that, but it sure was satisfying playing in front of him all those home games. I continued to work hard at Weber State. We also had a good team. Weber State was the only college in the state to be selected as part of a 32-team NCAA tournament, the first time in the school's history. Following my graduation, I was invited to try out for the Chicago Bulls in the NBA. I attended their rookie camp. I did not make the Bulls, but I was offered a contract to play in the American Basketball Association. Somehow playing professional basketball for the Pittsburgh Pipers just didn't quite have the same appeal to me as playing for the Chicago Bulls. I always felt Chicago Bulls never had any vision. So I hung up my gym shoes, joined the establishment, and decided to pursue my career in business. Now, I'm getting a little ahead of myself here, so let me backtrack a few years and tell you about my second goal. I mentioned the apprehension I had as a college freshman about my ability to succeed academically. I worked so hard that first quarter of college out of sheer fright, and I ended my freshman year getting all B's. And I was so relieved and happy. I had never been a B student, and it felt pretty good. And that is until I met my future wife, Margaret, in my sophomore year. She was a straight-A student, and I was never so dissatisfied with B's in all my life. So just as I had done in basketball, I began to work even harder. As I worked harder, my grades got better. As my grades got better, I gained more confidence academically, and in a very short period of time, I became an A student. As I started contemplating MBA programs, I decided to apply to Harvard. You can imagine the thrill I had from where I had started when I had learned I had been accepted. I had come a long way from that frightened freshman, but I must confess I was equally frightened those first few months in Boston. I often felt that everyone else had gotten into Harvard on pure ability, and maybe there had been some kind of computer error in my case. But I had discovered another interesting thing. About 80% of my classmates felt the same way. Someone captured our collective emotional state on a carved message on a restroom stall. You know, there are a lot of interesting things written on restroom stalls. It read, "This is the only place at the Harvard Business School where I really know what I'm doing." These two experiences from my early life had a profound influence on me and convinced me of some fundamental principles that are important factors in achieving success and achieving goals in one's life. Number one was believing in your potential. That is something that my parents instilled in me at a very early age. Number two was focus. Have a clear understanding of what you want to accomplish and don't get sidetracked with other things. Number three, develop a plan, an effective plan that gives one the right education, experience, and background to do what you want to do. In my case, I wanted to be a CEO of a Fortune 500 company. Four, work hard and be persistent. Again, my parents taught me that I could become anything I wanted and do anything I wanted if I worked hard enough and if I were persistent enough. Five, luck. Sometimes being in the right place at the right time makes a difference, but I'll always remember what my coach Dick Motta said about luck in winning basketball games. He said, "I believe in luck, but the harder I work, the luckier I get." Number six, while doing all of the above, keep the proper perspective and balance in what are the most important priorities in your life, and that is family, church, career, and community service. Because when it's all said and done, I believe my Heavenly Father will be far more interested in what kind of father and husband I was, my commitment to the Church of Jesus Christ, and how I treat my fellow man than being CEO of any company or making lots of money. Each of these principles have had a profound influence on both my personal and business life. When I graduated from Harvard, I had a clear vision that I wanted to become a CEO of a Fortune 500 company. With every job I took, I asked myself the question, would this better prepare me and give me the best experience I could get in becoming a general manager and subsequently a CEO? I also looked at where most CEOs came from. They came from operations, mostly from the dysfunctional areas of finance or marketing. Very few came from corporate staff positions. My first job out of business school was with Conroy Incorporated, a small conglomerate headquartered in San Antonio, Texas. Conroy had a small $3 million ladies' apparel company located in Montreal, Canada, that was losing $1 million a year. Now, it is not easy to lose $1 million a year on only $3 million in sales. I was asked to move to Montreal to conduct a real live case study on this $3 million ladies' apparel company and answer the two questions that's posed at almost the end of every Harvard case study, and that is, what would you do if you were CEO of this company and why? The former president had been fired from this company, and they had hired a new president that would begin in 3 months. The day before the new president was to start, he telephoned the CEO at Conroy and told them that he was not coming. He said, "This company is so messed up, nobody could turn it around." When the CEO told me this, I was shocked. I was even more surprised when he said, "We like everything you've done. We like your analysis. We like the plan you've put together. We think you have a good plan to turn this company around, and we're going to name you the CEO." So here I was, 3 months out of the Harvard Business School and CEO of a $3 million company. I don't know how you plan for something like that. It was certainly a stroke of very good luck. We turned the company around in 2 years and then sold it for a very good price. I was then asked to be vice president of marketing for the snowmobile division located in Thetford Mines, Quebec. The snowmobile division was also losing money. Thetford Mines is the ugliest town in North America. None of you here would have accepted that job. It was an asbestos mining town. I spent every other week for a whole year commuting to this hole in the mountain from Montreal. The president was fired 2 years later, and I was named president. We turned the company around in 2 additional years. We then sold the company to Kawasaki for an excellent price. I then lost out on my dream job, president of Glastron Boat Company. This was the largest division in Conroy, and the CEO felt like that he needed someone much older and with much more experience than I had. It was a bitter disappointment to me at the time. They had no vision either. I transferred to corporate headquarters at Conroy and headed up their mergers and acquisition activities. I almost went crazy doing corporate staff work. I quit before they fired me. I then became vice president of marketing for Airstream, a division of Beatrice Foods. Airstream manufactures these silver trailers and motorhomes, and they also manufacture trucks. Airstream was another turnaround situation. The president was fired a year after I arrived. I'm not very good news for presidents, am I? I again tried to convince me to name them president. They too wanted someone older with much more experience than I had. I stayed 9 months to help the new president in the transition. I was then named president of Delmar Window Coverings, another division of Beatrice Foods. This was also another turnaround situation. We turned this company around in 2 years. I was then named president of Stifel Lamp, another turnaround, and Delmar still reported to me at the time. We turned Stifel around, and they kept giving me more and more companies. I became president of the Home Products Group. Then one day I went to work, and I was told that Bill Stevens, my boss, had quit to become CEO of a Fortune 500 company, and they were naming me to succeed him. At 39 years of age, I would have responsibility for all the non-foods at Beatrice. This included Samsonite luggage, Culligan water treatment, Stifel Lamp, and 30 other companies, $2 billion in sales. I went home so excited, anxious to share this great news with my wife, Margaret. After arriving home and sharing her the activities of the day, upon hearing of my big promotion, she said, "They must be desperate." That is a true story. I worked for Jim Dutt, CEO of Beatrice. Jim Dutt was a very difficult person to work for. He was literally emotionally unbalanced. 3 years felt like an eternity. Beatrice executives were leaving in droves. I thought the board would wake up and fire him. So when I got a call from an executive research firm telling me that they were looking for a president and chief operating officer of Black & Decker, I told them that I was interested. 2 weeks later, after it was announced that I was leaving, the board fired Jim Dutt. I joined Black & Decker in late 1985. From 1980 to 1985, Black & Decker's earnings looked like a seesaw, and in 1985, the company reported a staggering loss of nearly $160 million. A month after this loss announcement, the board fired the CEO and named me his successor. When I was named CEO, Al Decker came to me and said, "Nolan, you are the third CEO we've had in 3 years. Good luck." That was 22 years ago. The 22 years that I have been CEO of Black & Decker can be divided into five major milestones or phases. Number one, the turnaround. Number two, the acquisition of Emhart. Number three, the launch of DeWalt Professional Power Tools. Four, the major repositioning and restructuring of the company. And five, our current bolt-on acquisition strategy. It is interesting that each of these milestones or phases are in approximately 5-year intervals. In a dynamic and changing marketplace, you must almost reinvent your company and yourself about every 5 years, or you won't be around any longer. That's probably why the average CEO tenure these days is 4 years. First, the turnaround. Black & Decker was getting killed by foreign competition. In addition to the financial losses, the company had also lost market share 5 years in a row. Its market share in the building and construction market had declined to just 5%. The company was losing money in both professional power tools and its accessory businesses. It was marginally profitable in the consumer power tool business and the small kitchen appliance business that had been purchased from GE a year before I joined the company. The thinking was when I joined the company that that Black & Decker would exit professional power tools and power tools accessories and bet their future on consumer power tools and small kitchen appliances, which are two very low profit businesses. The company needed a new strategy and a major turnaround. After considerable analysis and debate, we decided not to exit the professional power tool business nor the accessory business. Although they were doing poorly and losing money, we felt that these businesses had great potential. Both are very large markets. In fact, the professional and industrial power tool market is 2.5 times larger than the consumer power tool market. We developed a plan to turn the company around. We called it cut and build. Costs were high and we were saddled with acres of excess manufacturing capacity. We closed 4 plants and downsized several others. We reduced overhead and eliminated bureaucracy throughout the organization. In 2 years, we had replaced or reassigned nearly every general manager around the world. When a company is losing money, these are the kinds of things that you have to do, or someone else will come in and do them for you after you're gone. But all this does is stop the bleeding. The patient may still be dying, just not as fast. But you cannot cost-cut your way to prosperity. If all you do is cut, you'll be restructuring again and again every few years. In order to turn Black & Decker around, we needed to grow at the same time that we were cutting. We took some of the money that we saved on the cut side of the plan and poured it into the build side, into innovative new products, upgrading and expanding our sales force, and shoring up our marketing and engineering functions. It was an investment in the transition from being manufacturing-driven to being market-driven. To be a market-driven company, we focused on 4 major areas. 1, end-user needs. 2, providing our channels with the best channels of distribution with the best service in the industry. 3, innovative new products. And 4, quality. These market-driven principles still drive our company even today and keep our brand strong. What was the results of this cut-and-build strategy? After that $160 million loss in 1985, we recorded record sales and earnings just 3 years later. In 1988, sales grew 18% over respectable prior year, and profits rose 75%. Our return on equity shot up from a negative 26% to over 14% and 16% the following year. Today it is 30%. With Black & Decker back in the black, we felt that we needed to broaden our earnings base so we were not so dependent on such a few product lines. In 1989, we acquired the Emhart Corporation for $2.8 billion. Emhart manufactured quickset door locks, Price Pfister plumbing faucets, pop rivets and other mechanical and assembly fasteners, and several other companies we subsequently divested. We acquired some excellent brands and some excellent lines. The problem was that shortly after we made this huge acquisition, we had a severe recession. We had a lot of debt and were paying $1 million a day in interest in a very difficult economy. We slugged our way through this. Fortunately, we sold a number of the businesses that we acquired with Emhart for very high prices and ended up getting the ones that we kept at very good values. Although we're a better and more stable company today for having made the Emhart acquisition, with the benefit of hindsight, I would not have made that acquisition because of the risk and size of it. In 1992, although we had made good progress, we still had not found the right formula to significantly grow our professional and our industrial power tools business. Although we were number one in the consumer power tools market and number one in the high-end industrial market, we were number three in the very large building and construction market. Makita was number one with 43% market share. Milwaukee was number two with 15%, and the Black & Decker brand of professional tools was only 5%. We developed a strategy to become the preferred brand and the market share leader in this large segment of the market. In developing this strategy, we first looked at which brand to lose. In 1991, an independent marketing firm, Landor Associates, ranked Black & Decker as the seventh most powerful brand in the United States using a composite of quality of products and brand awareness. The big question was, do you abandon the seventh most powerful brand in the United States for a new brand? Although the Black & Decker brand was exceptionally strong, it was primarily viewed as a consumer brand, particularly by end users in the building and construction segment. A factor making the decision even more difficult was that we did very well under the Black & Decker industrial brand in the high end of the industrial market. In 1960, Al Decker had purchased the DeWalt company, maker of radial arm saws used in lumber yards. 30 years later, in 1992, we had no products that we were selling in the United States under the DeWalt brand and only one in Europe, a high-precision table saw used for industrial use. In our market research, we discovered that DeWalt had a 70% aided brand awareness and ranked number three with professional users only behind Milwaukee and Makita. Because of the quality of these old DeWalt radial arm saws, these tools had an unbelievable reputation with end users. After much internal debate, we concluded that DeWalt was the brand to go to market with. From there, we did extensive research on color, packaging, service, warranty, and especially product. We started with 33 high-grade industrial tools. 12 months later, we added 57 additional for a total of 90. We also introduced over 150 DeWalt accessories, from saw blades to router bits. And in 1994, we introduced a new generation of power tools called Compact Power that revolutionized the cordless power tool business. Today, we have over 300 power tools and 2,500 accessories under the DeWalt brand name. And we have nearly 70% of the professional and industrial cordless tools market in the United States, and nearly 40% of the overall market. Today, Makita has approximately 11% market share, and Milwaukee 18%. Sales have gone from zero 15 years ago to over $2 billion today. In fact, we sell more DeWalt tools today than Black & Decker tools because, as I mentioned, the industrial and professional market is 2.5 times larger than the consumer market. DeWalt is one of the most successful cases in the history of American business. The Harvard Business School wrote a case study about it, and it is used in each of their curriculum. And I think many of you have just studied the DeWalt case recently here at BYU-Idaho. In the late 90s and early 2000s, we were seeing an increasing number of higher and higher quality products come into the United States and Europe at lower and lower prices. Our consumer power tools business in Europe and our small kitchen appliance business in the United States were particularly hard hit. We determined that we needed to dramatically change our cost base if we were going to survive this competitive threat. For example, labor rates in the United States and Western European factories, fully loaded with all benefits and wages, averages between $18 and $25 an hour. This compares to $3.25 in Eastern Europe, $3 in Mexico, and $1.50 in China. In 1998, we announced a comprehensive strategic repositioning and restructuring plan designed to reduce costs and improve operating performance. Over a two-year period, the plan would divest non-strategic businesses, including our small kitchen appliance business, which was our lowest performing business, reduce our manufacturing floor space by 25%, transfer most of our consumer products and some of our professional products from high-cost plants located in the United States and Europe to low-cost plants located in Mexico, China, and the Czech Republic, and eliminate 3,000 positions, 10% of our workforce. This program was very well received by our shareholders. We sold our small kitchen appliance business for $325 million. Today, we license the Black & Decker name to the buyer and receive royalties between $14 and $15 million, which was about what we made when we owned the business. The manufacturing restructuring resulted in over $250 million in annual savings. As a result of this program, we generated $1.9 billion from free cash flow and divestitures, purchased 20% of our outstanding stock, and reduced our debt by over $700 million, a 40% reduction. Today, Black & Decker is cost competitive with any power tool company in the world, including those located in China. Our balance sheet is also in great shape, and the company has generated over $500 million of free cash flow in each of the last 4 years. We are well positioned to make our bolt-on acquisitions to supplement our sales and our profit growth. In the past 5 years, we have made 4 bolt-on acquisitions. We acquired Baldwin and Weiser Locks and Hardware in 2003 for $278 million. This acquisition increased the sales of our hardware and home improvement group to nearly $1 billion. We are now the number one residential lock company in the world, or in the United States. In 2004, we acquired the $1 billion Porter Cable and Delta professional and industrial power tools business for $768 million, which nearly doubled our professional and industrial sales in the United States. And in 2006, we acquired Vector Automotive and Electronic Products for $158 million. With these acquisitions, Black & Decker sales are now over $6.5 billion. Today, Black & Decker has extremely strong market positions in each of our businesses. In fact, we believe that we are number one in each of our businesses except PriceVister, where we are a number three. We believe that our sales, marketing, and new product innovation are world-class. Our stock has also done well over time. Through February, Black & Decker stock has outperformed the S&P 500 the past 5 years, the past 10 years, and the past 15 years, despite the severe downturn in residential housing. Throughout my career, I have also tried to keep my priorities right. When my son Jordan said at his missionary farewell how much he appreciated his father attending every one of his varsity lacrosse and basketball games during his 4 years in college, and how much it meant to him, that was more important to me than being CEO of any company, more important than all the money I've made or any honor I have received. I have also always accepted any call that has come to me in the church. Although it is not easy being a stake president or a bishop when you're the CEO of a $6 billion company, father of 8 active children, and active in community service, yet I would do anything the church asked me to do. throughout my life, although not easy, I have tried to balance the priorities which are most important in my life, and that is family, church, career, and community service. My family and the church are by far my most important priorities. Part of keeping your priorities right is also having the integrity and courage to be honest and ethical in everything that you do. Ned Hill, Dean of the Marriott School of Management, defines ethical courage as the strength to act appropriately in questionable situations. He says ethical courage is difficult to teach because its roots are formed through years of learning to be courageous in small things. Dean Hill defines ethical leadership as instilling in others a desire to develop ethical awareness and courage. This higher form of ethical behavior requires a person to inspire others through word, example, persuasion, and good management. BYU Idaho students typically come to this great university having been taught by their parents of what is acceptable and what is not. This unique preparation produces men and women with the most ethical and highest integrity of anyone in the world today. You BYU Idaho students can have an enormous impact and influence in the world because of your integrity and high ethical standards. You have the power to be the salt of the earth, to be a seasoning, a savoring, a preserving influence in the world today if you live the gospel and maintain your standards. I have never found my standards to be a challenge or an hindrance in my business career. In fact, I believe that living our religion is a competitive advantage, especially in this post-Enron environment. People like to work with someone who is honest, has integrity, and trustworthy. It has been a fun and exciting life so far, and hopefully I've got some good years ahead of me. I recently made the cover of Fortune magazine. Don't I look like I've got some good years ahead of me? That concludes my remarks.